Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast FAA Regulatory Guidance for Multi-Core Usage in Certified Avionics Systems. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speakers Joe Vlad from Wind River and Vance Hilderman from Vector Software. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation, leaving about 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some important features of your viewing console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate in today's event. You can simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the material presentation. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material and the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many as we can during the closing Q&A, and if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you could submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you during the eCast. Our speakers today are a very accomplished group in the world of avionics. Joe Vlad is the Senior Director of Product Management at Wind River. Joe has over 25 years of embedded engineering and marketing experience, including work on GPS programs and the space shuttle, aircraft test and certification at McDonnell Douglas, and aircraft engineering at United Airlines. Joe is a Federal Aviation Administration designated engineering representative for systems and equipment and software. He's also an active instrument-rated private pilot and has co-authored 3 patents on global positioning system integrity functions. He holds a BS in aerospace engineering from the University of Buffalo and an MBA from Santa Clara University. Vance Hilderman is the Director of Global Services at Vector Software. Vance has focused on safety-critical avionics software, systems, and hardware development and related technical products for 25 years, and is considered an expert on safety-critical software, computer systems, and certification. Vance has consulted with 95 of the world's 100 largest aerospace companies, plus numerous medical, industrial, and telecommunications entities. He's also the author of the world's best-selling book on avionics development certification, published by Avionics Communications, entitled Avionics Certification, A Complete Guide to DO-178B and DO-254. Gentlemen, welcome, and Joe, I believe you have the floor first. Take it away.
Thank you very much, Kurt, and thank you, everyone, for joining today. What I'm going to talk about is first give you an overview of the architectures available for avionics development and then how that's evolved into a multi-core design. And then I'll recap some certification issues related to multi-core usage and describe how our customers and how we at Wind River are going about addressing certification requirements for multi-core development. And what we've uncovered in that process so far is that there might be alternatives at our disposal that may make the certification effort a little less arduous and maybe a little more predictable. I'll talk about a couple of technologies that have been in vogue now for 10 years or more related to modeling, architecture analysis and design language, systems theoretical accident modeling process, a technology being promoted by Nancy Levison at MIT. I'll talk about automated safety analysis, simulation platforms, and vulnerability analysis. And these are key technologies that can help augment the work that we're doing in multi-core certification, and with that bring forth the best practices that we could together cooperate on for multi-core development. And then I'll hand the presentation over to Vance, where he'll talk about Vector's perspective on multi-core and the verification needs for multi-core avionics. And then lastly, we'll conclude with some polling and Q&A. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. And first of all, I'm going to introduce you why Wind River is talking about this today. Well, Wind River's got experience in DO-178 certifications dating back to 2000 in both the FAA and EASA-related projects. We've been around since 1981 with our VxWorks technology. We were acquired by Intel in 2009. We've got almost 2,000 employees and have over 42,000 developers using our technology. So I think it's relevant that Wind River talk about what we're seeing in multi-core and what our customers are doing. And in order to help them achieve their goals, you know, we're participating with them in doing certification services. We offer ability to architect their designs, help them pick the silicon for best practices in using and deploying their applications, doing gap analysis and planning on their part, and giving them the complete certification lifecycle evidence from PSAC to the SAS. We can also provide support and maintenance in the products that we provide, as well as getting them up and running on the new hardware that they're designing. So it's relevant that we talk about some of the things we're seeing in the technologies and projects we're working on, and that's why it's important that Wind River at least bring to bear what we're seeing. And I'm hoping you'll gather as much information as possible from this presentation, and hopefully can follow up with us or your other customers to help put some of these best practices into use. So let's go back to the past. Things were simple. If you consider just the GPS technology, and this is my favorite example, the Manpack GPS in the mid-80s, it was a monolithic design, weighed 17 pounds, had one channel, did sequential tracking, tracked one satellite at a time, and it took you 8 minutes to find out where you were. And the military used this to improve field operations and save lives. And if we fast forward to what we can do today, if you look at the Snapdragon SoC, Qualcomm has taken all this technology and integrated it in with other features like video, cell phone technology, and essentially the GPS is now relegated to a very small piece of the silicon on this 5-gram part, does 24-channel parallel tracking, gives you a first fix in 5 seconds, and what do people do with it? Well, they tell their friends where they are on Facebook. So we've taken this very complex technology, put it onto an SoC, and turned it into a commodity. That's what's happened. But in this evolution, things have gotten more complicated. We've reduced the footprint of our silicon designs and increased the complexity by increasing the transistor count. So one question to ask is what sort of features and functions can we see on these future airborne multi-core processors? So some of the issues that our customers have to address today for multi-core certification is they first have to make an architectural choice. Do they want to deploy the multi-core silicon in an asynchronous multiprocessing mode, meaning one partition per core? Or perhaps they want to take advantage of using those cores in one partition in a symmetric multiprocessing way so they can take advantage of increased performance in singular applications. And each of those architectural choices have pros and cons, because if you want to reuse existing technology, it might be better to go with an AMP architecture. If you want to reuse third-party technology, it might be better in an AMP architecture. If you want to increase the performance of your application or applications, it may be better to go with an SMP technology. And each of those choices bring in different implications regarding certification. And I won't go into the details here, because what I want to put forth is at least a hypothesis and an alternative for people to consider when they're doing multi-core certification, regardless of the architectures they choose. So once you pick the architectural choice for multi-core, then you've got to worry about the certification guidelines of DO-178, DO-297 if you're considering IMA development, DO-254 if you're trying to address complex hardware, DO-326, if you're worried about security issues, you may need to address ARINC 653 if you're talking about portability and interoperability. And then, of course, there is now published the latest FAA and EASA guidance regarding multi-core certification. So I'm going to recap some of the system issues that you'd see and why this is becoming problematic for developers in multi-core addressing airborne certification. First of all, there are contention for shared resources inside the silicon, and that makes it difficult to prove that the timing constraints can be met. Most of these SoC designs that we have at our disposal today in the COTS world have shared hardware, shared memory buses, shared caches between the cores, so they're not completely separated. And the design or effects of sharing those resources are either unavailable or sometimes proprietary to the silicon vendor. And as these designs evolve in the production runs, some of the microcode in that silicon could be revised, which may change or potentially alter its behavior. So if you looked at the DO-178 or DO-254 perspective and say, well, I'm going to use that as my means of verification, well, I think that's going to certainly lead to uncertainty in proof. That how confident can we be using those techniques alone to verify the behavior of these complex devices? So if we look at how complicated things have become over the last decade, the transistor count on currently available silicon today exceeds 2 billion, and that will continue to grow. So by example here, I have the Intel SoC architectures and the graphics technology that's there, the multi-cores, the shared caches. And on the left-hand side, you can see Moore's Law and how the transistor count has just linearly increased over time. So what we're postulating here is it's virtually impossible to verify all potential states of execution when we're talking about transistor counts that are so high. And now that we have reduced the size of the silicon even further, we're down to 14 and 22 nanometer designs. The FAA and the EASA regulators are becoming a little more nervous about those very small design plans because of the vulnerabilities that may exist in the environmental conditions. So we've got two factors going against us in multi-core design: the complexity, transistor counts, and of course the reduced dimensions of the silicon. So how do people tackle this today? And this is what we're seeing in the current certification programs we're active in now, is that you can treat the multi-core processors as a COTS component and then deactivate all but one core, and that ostensibly will reduce the burden of certification to demonstrating non-interference from that deactivated or those deactivated cores. You've got to go through exhaustive testing and analysis of DO-178, worst case execution time, all the stuff you had to do for the single core platforms. So that's possible and certainly one way to address multi-core certification. And then the other thing you could do to reduce the problem set is to utilize more than one core and design to a single level of criticality across all those cores. And in that particular model, your certification burden then becomes one of integration. Can I make my applications or the processes that are sharing the resources cooperate in a way that ensures that level of criticality? So it becomes really a testing and verification burden, but again, that particular model, you may be able to say, I can get one level of assurance across two cores. And we've seen that done, and we have participated in those certifications previously. And the other way to do it is use more than one core and to design multiple levels of criticality across an AMP or SMP configuration, and then you'll have to worry about all the FAA CAS 32 guidance. And I've not talked about specifically what's in that guidance today, but largely it's all about addressing how you can ensure the behavior of your application or applications don't result in conflict when using some of the resources that are shared. So one way to go about that is to use this brute force testing and analysis method. The OS supplier would do their part, the integrator does their part, and hopefully arriving at a point where people are confident that enough work has been done. So in this particular example, I've got a snapshot of one of the CAS 32 objectives. And this is just one example. It's called Determinism 7. And there's where you're trying to do a functional interference analysis to identify all the channels between the software hosted on the various cores and that you've mitigated the means of interference across those channels. And the way we work with our customers to address that is we do a robust partitioning analysis. We create robustness requirements for using those shared resources, and we test and verify them in a DO-178 form. But when we put it in a compliance matrix, we say we can't take full credit for this because even though we can verify some levels of partitioning in the interference channels, we can't guarantee that any given customer is going to use them appropriately. So we give the completion of that credit to the integrator to say, you're going to be responsible for taking full credit based on some of the work that we do and some of the work that you do. And from our point of view, there may be a little bit of work on your end or maybe a lot of work, but potentially it's going to be a lot of testing and analysis no matter what the OS supplier does for you. And again, this is more the brute force mechanisms in play today. So if you look at the roles and responsibilities for certification, there's generally the system integrator who works with the OS supplier like us. They're developing certification plans. They're giving them to the certification authority, and we're giving our certification plans to the integrator who gives them the certification authority. And we're both kind of interacting with a silicon vendor to get more information about errata, more information about design information, as much as we can get to understand the behavior of the system. So what we're doing is we're creating this brute force data package, doing DO-178 evidence, robust partitioning, working with the errata, vulnerability analysis, and doing all this data. And what ends up happening is, we have this mountain of evidence that we produce. But the question that we ask is, despite doing all this work, how do we know when we are really done? Because we can't argue that we've verified every possible state of behavior of that multi-core silicon. So we have to use some other means, and this is what we're postulating here, to address that. And what we're saying is we can't verify all the behavior using just conventional DO-178 or 254 techniques, no matter what pieces of silicon you're using. And the other thing that we're going to have to worry about is the silicon designs shrink, the exposure to single event upsets, or what they call soft errors or transient errors, increases because of the fact you've got more gates in the silicon, more transistors, so there's more potential for the environment to cause bit flips. So what we're saying is that a system-level approach would augment or maybe even replace some of these DO-XXX activities, and that would rely more on system analysis and design techniques similar to that at the aircraft and avionics-level certification. And so what do we have at our disposal for those capabilities? Well, one thing that we've done some research on, and this is being postulated by Nancy Levison at MIT, and this has been in practice for quite some time, is a technique called systems theoretic accident model and process. And the theory there is that accidents and events in safety-related systems evolve as a complex dynamic process. And the theory here is based on systems and control theory. There is a feedback and control mechanism that you're trying to create and constrain the behavior of the environment that you're designing. And unlike traditional hazard analysis techniques, STAMP uses external factors and what Nancy Levison calls the socio-technical system. So you're looking at organizational factors, dynamic factors that characterize some of the complex systems. And while this is being applied at a system level, what we're saying here is we can also apply this at the computing level as well, because we're talking about subsystems within that silicon that are interacting. And if we're going to focus on a systems level certification, we can focus on the interactions of those parts of the silicon where there may be coupling or dependencies. And are we actually ensuring that we can meet some of the higher level safety requirements using one of these techniques? So in STAMP, there's a great analog to 4761, that is that verification process of system safety analysis at the aircraft level. So that's one thing that can be used or put into our arsenal. Some of the other things that have been done are some research at Carnegie Mellon that uses the architecture analysis design language to focus on the interaction between three components of a system, the aircraft level platform, the application software, and the computing platform. And they're focusing on the interactions between all those three elements and the dependencies that might be created when, for example, an application software calls on a resource from the computer platform. What vulnerabilities might be exposed, what hazards and vulnerabilities may need to be mitigated in that type of interaction. Likewise, at the aircraft level to computing level, the same type of thing may need to apply. So again, you can start to look at these two examples as more of a technique of trying to do a safety net around the silicon design rather than trying to brute force verify the actual design build and testing of the low-level silicon itself. So if we look at this in a ARP 4761 model, that is the system safety assessment process at the aircraft level certification, where you go through this V model. And what that means is we're going to do use model-driven techniques to create a system model of behavior that ultimately will flow down from the system level to the aircraft level to the component level, down to the computing platform, and right down to the silicon. And where we may be able to use some of those models to help explore and verify the behavior of that computing platform. We're not neglecting the fact that we need to rely on DO-178 and our 254 techniques, but we're augmenting it with some of these other techniques. And then on the right-hand side of the V model, we would go through and trace all those elements back up to failure modes and effects analysis, fault trees, and the aircraft level certification. So we're just augmenting what we're doing at the computing platform level with other techniques. Rockwell and the University of Minnesota also did some research, and this is where I think we'll get some payoff in the multi-core world, is that they created techniques to do an automated safety analysis. And what they did was try to integrate system and safety engineering in a common model. So they created formalized safety requirements, integrated that in with some of the proofs of the safety properties that they were trying to design, hosted that on a simulation platform to help verify the behavior of those models, and then were able to auto-generate some of the fault trees. And then, of course, they would have to correlate the fault trees with some more verification. You know, that is some of the evidence to support the outcomes of those fault trees. But the beauty of this particular technique is that you can have a living repository for some of the results. And in the multi-core silicon world, where we're verifying software and hardware, we would use this as a way to keep building that repository, following that SAMP model as the control process of a feedback of what we learn and feed that back into the model, maybe augment or modify fault trees as we go through the rest of the verification activities. And in the end, when we think we're done with certification, and I don't think we ever really are, is that we have a snapshot of what it is we've done. And if we expose later on errata that we haven't considered before, we can see what the impact on the fault trees or things at the system level might be, because we learn things as we go. We discover new faults and new methods and things that we take into account, that element of learning. So the other thing we're doing here at Wind River, simulation platforms pay some big dividends. We're hosting our Wind River operating system on our Simix platform. That's an instruction set simulator. It's an identical model of the CPU itself. So you can pick a CPU, whether it's an Intel or a Freescale part. We've created models of these that can be used to help test and verify the software. And in there, you can start to explore some of the abilities of the behavior of the silicon by, you know, running in fault injection, trying to see what happens when a fault occurs, doing reverse execution. And it's an ideal way to help verify some of the safety requirements using a model like this. The other thing I'll talk about in closure here before I hand it off to Vance is dealing with transient errors. So I talked earlier in the presentation about the fact that since these silicon designs are becoming very, very small and now below 32 nanometers, we know that exposure to single event upsets will increase. And I worked with my colleagues at Intel to gather some information on the research they've done here, and they published a number of papers on this. I cite one down here in the bottom of the presentation. And what they've done is gone through a model where they're able to predict the vulnerability factor of the silicon they're designing to these transient errors. And the transient errors ideally would be caused by, you know, a gamma ray or some some environmental exposure that would trigger a bit flip within one of the gates of the silicon. And what they've done is they've created a model, very high fidelity model of their silicon designs. Of course, it's proprietary to Intel in this particular case, but it's allowed them to help produce and create vulnerability factors for these designs. And they categorize them in three ways. They're architectural vulnerability factors. They're related strictly to the design of the silicon itself and the workload that's placed on that silicon. There's also timing factors that go into the vulnerability of the silicon in the environmental world, and that's based on frequency and voltage. And there's a third element of vulnerability related to the programmatics, and that is the application code that's running on there. So what Intel has direct control over is trying to verify the architecture and timing components of the vulnerability factors and making some assumptions about programmatics. And so they're able to provide users, like our customers, with what they predict they could see in the real world based on exposure, whether those bit flips might matter or may not matter. And the way they go about this is they do fault injection. So they have a model, they inject a fault, and then look at the outcome of that particular fault. And does that fault get detected? Does it get overwritten? Does it even matter? So they do this, and they iterate and repeat, and they just collect data. What they're trying to do is verify that architectural vulnerability factor by doing this. And in many cases, some bit flips don't even matter. If a bit flips inside, the program of execution, the outcome is unaffected. So they use that information to predict these architectural vulnerability factors and provide that to the vendors. What we have at our disposal, though, is if we're developing programs to run on these models, or at least on the SoC silicon, what we don't know is what the vulnerability factor is related to our computer program. Maybe we're sharing resources inside the silicon. If there is a vulnerability or single bit upset that we want to understand a little bit better, what we could do is work with the silicon providers to provide them examples of the application code that they could put through that model to see what alterations in the vulnerability factors might occur. And by doing that, we get more information about and maybe more confidence in the designs that we're putting forth in airborne systems. So that's another thing at our disposal to help us do some of this work. So I want to summarize in a couple of points here is that the current complexity and design size of these multi-core processors make it impractical to verify all the behavior using conventional DO-254 and 178 techniques. The CAS-32 objectives require that we start to address the issues of shared resources within these silicon devices and make sure that we can manage and control them properly. And so we need more at our disposal to understand the behavior of those systems. And to increase the confidence there, we're going to have to use these other techniques, STAMP, some of the modeling techniques, simulation platforms, and work with our silicon vendors to help us understand more about the vulnerability factors to get approval in these multi-core systems. And you can see in there that we're using more of a safety methodology to help verify our applications. I'll certainly admit that readily. But the other thing we're taking stock in is that many of these silicon designs have been perpetuated over decades. So the way Intel has built their SoCs today is largely predicated on using IP that's been in play for a number of years. So the Intel core instruction set largely remains unchanged today. They're reusing a lot of that IP. So we put the same faith in that IP as a COTS microprocessor back in, 10 or 15 years ago when we certified airborne systems. And what we're saying here is we're going to rely largely on doing that same thing in these complex SoCs, but we're going to use other techniques to help verify the behavior. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Vance and let him now discuss what they're seeing in the multi-core silicon world at Vector Software. Over to you now, Vance.
Very good. Thanks so much. So, Kurt and everybody out there, thanks for dialing in, clicking in, and tuning in today. As you can see, multi-core has multiple aspects. And tying in with that multi-core, let's start off and have a little bit of fun, test our knowledge. We engineers and technical folks all like to think we're in the top 1%, and I'm sure everybody tuning in, listening today probably is, but let's see if you really can tune in on the answers to these very simple, seemingly questions. Four true or false questions, 50% chance of getting them right. We'll do the answers in just 10 or 12 minutes when we're done with this verification portion of the presentation. So first question, true or false, CAS-32, and that's Certification Authority Software Team, it's an international worldwide body that reconciles differences between certification guidelines and improving the understanding of certification. CAS-32, their 30-second memo, explains multi-core verification needs well. True or false? Number two, by having a good deterministic multi-core design, verification activities are reduced. Surely, huh? Number three, true or false, multi-core verification will require knowledge of the processor and RTOS certification. And number four, continuous testing and automated regression testing will be even more important with multi-core designs. So true, false, four quick questions. Let's see how we did in just a few minutes. First off, real quick, I'm with Vector Software. I'm the Director of Global Services. We do a wide variety of training, testing, continuum-based testing, setting up frameworks for safety-critical testing. We do on-site training, project consulting, best practices workshops, continuous test implementation, and we're primarily focused on industry standards compliance, such as DO-178 that we're talking about today. With that, multi-core perspectives are very interesting. Let's take a look at seven perspectives. Number one, it's true that multi-core solutions are increasingly ubiquitous. If we come from other industries, we know that increasingly it's getting harder to find processor chipsets, single board computers that aren't multi-core. Some have said in 10 years it'll be very difficult to find systems without multi-cores. Number two, just as with OOT, object-oriented technology usage, a safe multi-core subset needs to be defined, implemented, and verified. Truly, it's possible to really push the envelope of multi-core design and have some very interesting designs that work, but we simply can't prove they work. And in this business, if we can't prove it, we're guilty. So let's see how we can prove that we have a safe design. Number three, CAS32 is a very good document, but it's not the final word. It's the first document in this industry, our FAA world and EASA world, but it's not the final. Please do expect clarifications. There are numerous clarifications in work as we work through our first certifications of complex systems to DO-178C. You will be seeing more clarifications. Number four, truly, avionics application developers need to rely on a certifiable operating system because that operating system does so much of the verification and the control, improving and showing that determinism, and also for compliance. Number five, on the next slide, we can see that unlike single-core processing, multi-core usage will require an application architect to use intimate processor knowledge. Now, most of us on single-core applications could implement entire projects without a single developer on the team really understanding the intricacies, for example, of that microprocessor, DSP, microcontroller architecture. That will not be the case. You're going to need at least a couple people on your team, one to ensure the design meets CAS32 requirements and more, the other to verify independently for level A and B that that was done. Number six, as with DO-178, remember, with multi-core, even more, we are all guilty until proven innocent. Rather opposite of our Western laws we live under, innocent until proven guilty, here we're going to need to use multi-core requirements, design, and verification very wisely to prove that innocence. And lastly, number seven, whereas continuous-based testing in our old world was a great idea, here in multi-core, it's going to be nearly mandatory, combined with automated regression testing. The reason for that is there are so many more potential paths of interaction and communication, as Joe was describing, that indeed a gradual integration process is going to be almost mandatory. And that's why CAS 32 itself, on page 18, section 8, specifically cited gradual integration, which remember, DO-297, Integrated Modular Avionics, that's rather the process there, isn't it? How we gradually integrate the subsystems, systems, and the integrated modular avionics themselves. The same paradigm will apply here with multi-core, so that automated testing and that continuous-based testing are really going to need to be a mainstay of our verification strategy. Going on to the next slide, we can see that multi-core has a particular emphasis. In traditional systems, we know we have, number one, a small planning process. It's very important. It's red. It's on the left. followed by a development process, where development isn't just code development, multi-core application development. It's actually requirements development, the safety determination, the architecture, then the high-level requirements, the low-level requirements, the design for multi-core. And in the background, we're going to have that correctness process that specifically addresses that multi-core determinism, rationalizing and proving it, and then ultimately ensuring that we have CAS 32 compliant reviews, testing, analysis, and audits. Without multi-core, many times we don't do a lot of analysis. We do everything by discrete testing. That's not going to be completely possible in this case. We're going to need, all of us, to do some additional analysis to prove that our designs are compliant with the processor, the operating system, and multi-core CAS 32 itself. On the next slide, let's look at some specific verification processes. Remember, in DO-178C, with or without multi-core, verification consists of three things. You have to read between lines to understand this, but those with experience know all too well. Verification is reviews, tests, and analysis. For multi-core, each of these, as we'll see on the subsequent pages and that Joe already talked about, these require strengthening many of the verification activities, specifically for synchronization, tasks with the operating system, concurrency, and timing issues. And that's why that continuous-based testing, that automated regression testing, is going to be so important. Now, DO-178C, many in the industries, including a few very smart FAA people we work with, have joked that the D in DO stands for determinism. Well, we know it doesn't, but all of us in the industry act as if it did. Our number one goal is determinism and improving that determinism. Well, multi-core obfuscates some of that, but when done safely, we have tremendous performance improvements. That's why we're going that way. So multi-core verification must assess all possible runtime core and resource usage combinations. So that worst-case performance testing, many of us put under robustness testing in Section 6 of DO-178C, that's always been a little vague, a little subjective. Well, multi-core directly improves that worst-case performance testing, so we're going to need additional analysis in how we calculate that worst core based on the core, the affinity, and the assignment. That means, on the next slide, we can see that we need additional details. Now, remember, our goal in DO-178 is to, in theory, be able to write such nicely detailed requirements that we can have two different teams separated by a firewall and thousands of kilometers that can implement functionally equivalent systems. Well, for multi-core, that means we need much greater requirement clarification at the low level, LLRs, low-level requirements, to specifically describe that core affinity and ensure that we have all possible core task allocations are tested. So we want to use all active cores, all possible cores. If we can show that some combinations or some cores are permanently disabled, well, we have to show that. Then we can avoid that. Otherwise, remember, guilty and proven innocent, we have to show those combinations are completely tested. Lastly on this slide, we need to define detailed robustness and performance tests to prove that there's no collisions. And remember, again, for the third time we're saying in this presentation, guilty until proven innocent. We have to prove that we are innocent of invoking collisions between processes or between resources between cores. So that means, specifically, we need to verify the task concurrency, work with the RTOS certification to do that, use interference analysis to see if we are introducing or reliant upon or in any way have side effects that might be subjugated by interference. Next, we need to analyze the shared memory access, then verify any unused coherency features. We need to make sure that if we say they're unused, they really are. So 178C, as we know, tightens up the requirements for deactivated and further strengthens the complete removal of dead code and functionality. So we're going to need detailed timing analysis for that task interoperation as well. On the next slide, we can see the traditional testing, but strengthened and clarified for multi-core. Functional testing, we're going to need detailed requirements added and specific tests for multi-core. And remember, there's four types of testing: functional, normal range, robustness, and structural. Next on the normal range, we need to ensure that we have tests for all assigned and potential core affinities. On robustness tests, it gets very interesting here. We're going to need significantly expanded testing for the worst case execution times across all possible core assignment combinations. And here's where that automated regression testing, because any time we change our software, our tasking, or we're all working with asynchronous systems, when our load changes, we can have a change in the worst case execution time. So we have to analyze that to show that we really are across multiple paradigms, multiple viewpoints for that worst case execution time. And finally, structural coverage. Remember, it's not just executing any code, it's about executing all instances. For example, in a system, simple state transition, we have to show all possible state transitions, not just that each line of code, decision condition, MCDC was covered. So we're going to need to look at all instances on any core combination for the structural coverage that's running on that core. On the next slide, we answer our questions. And I see that we've got quite a few questions from the audience coming in. So let's do the answers to these interesting questions we looked at just 10 minutes ago. Number one, CAS 32 explains multi-core verification needs well. No, it's false. Remember, some people unfairly criticize DO-178 because it doesn't provide a detailed how-to. Well, the answer is that, no, that's not what it's supposed to. 178 is a guideline. CAS 32 is a guideline. The how-to is provided in your or our verification plans, our development plans. CAS 32 is just a guideline to explain what is required, not how to do it. It's up to us. That is false. Number two, interesting. By having a good deterministic multi-core design, verification activities are reduced. Well, remember, whether you have a great perfect design or an imperfect design, you have the same amount of verification. Okay, a little humor there. Same amount of verification. With a weak design, you're simply going to have more defects that verification caught. Testing doesn't directly improve quality. It assesses quality. Number three, multi-core verification will require knowledge of the processor and RTOS certification. That is true. And number four, continuous testing and automated regression testing will be even more important with multi-core designs. That is a truly. With that, I'd like to turn it back over to Kurt. We'll take your questions now. Kurt, go ahead.
Great. Thanks a bunch. We are now to the Q&A portion of the event. We've got some good questions coming in, and we want you to keep asking those questions as we go here. First, let's start with Joe. Joe, there's a question about irrespective of whether you go with asymmetric or symmetric multiprocessing, how do you solve the contention in the memory controller? Will we be limited to dual-core solutions, each of the cores going through a separate memory controller?
Yeah, so I think that's certainly easier to verify and understand. If you have one partition or domain that uses cores or core on one side of that memory bus or one dedicated memory bus, then yes, you're going to have, by hardware design, limitations on contention. So that's certainly one way to address the problem and reduce the problem set. The certification program we're going through today does not make that assumption. So yes, there are. If you're going to have multiple partitions making use of that shared resource, then we, as the OS supplier, are doing our robust required robust partitioning analysis and robust testing robustness requirements for shared use of that resource. And certainly, we're going to go through and explore the behavior to the extent that we can of that resource. Now, when our customers start to deploy applications and use, maybe place a heavier burden on that shared resource, then that's when compromises may need to be made. What we do give our customers is the ability to constrain the behavior of these multi-core systems in such a way that they can make access and use of that shared resource more predictable. And that's some of the technology that we're putting forth in our VxWorks 63 3.0 operating environment.
Great. Vance, there's a question from someone who references Dijkstra, who's a fairly well-known computer scientist in the late 50s, early 60s. He says, Dijkstra says that testing finds only the anticipated problems, not all of the bugs. Can you do you agree with that? And how does that fit into the context of what we're talking about here with, you know, robustness and certification testing?
It's a terrific question, and I'd have to say that to a large degree, I do agree with Mr. Dijkstra, who says that testing finds only the anticipated problems. And that's interesting. That thought was known in 1980 at the time of the creation of DO-178. And also, let's keep in mind that the mythical man month that anyone over the age of 50, perhaps like me, I've got a few years over 50, might be well aware of. And that is why 178 says it's not just about testing. In fact, we don't have a testing integral process in 178. It's called the correctness process. And what we do is expand the scope of testing to say, you know, it's more than that. We need reviews. We need actual tests, but four types of tests, including robustness testing and structural coverage that weren't used at the time, Dijkstra. And also, finally, we have the certification liaison process with technical analysis. All of those work together to say, let's add independence so that we don't just focus on unit testing by a developer or non-independent developer-based testing, but use all those tools. And with multi-core, that becomes a bigger issue. It almost opens the door to formal methods, which are not a form of testing, but they're a form of correctness and analysis evaluation that is a further tool within CAS 32 to help us with multi-core. So to summarize, yes, that's a really good problem, but that problem pertains to all testing, which is why 178 does so much more than just testing. That's it.
And so, Kurt, yeah, I'll maybe just chime in on that particular question as well, and maybe a point that I didn't bring up during the presentation, which I think hits on this, because I certainly agree with that observation as well, is that, you know, if you're testing it, you're looking to verify the errors that you would expect. And the techniques that we put forth here today, more at the system level, and trying to put our heads around the interactions of these complex systems and the interactions of the complex components of the silicon. If we put forth some of these other techniques, we can augment and try to find and explore behaviors that we're not just looking for by brute force testing. So augmenting it with 178 and 254 is certainly paramount. Modeling, we're going to need to verify the fidelity of the models. So there's no free lunch here, but we're saying there are other techniques to help us get around that particular dilemma of just trying to verify what we know to be correct and what we expect to be correct.
Joe, is there already a guideline established for the CAS 32, and will it be evolving?
I expect it will be evolving. And there's another question here I think that relates to the fact that CAS 32 today limits the number of cores to two. And that is indeed correct. That's the current CAS guidance. But we've already talked to the FAA about that guidance and said that the horses left the barn, so to speak. There are already designs that we're involved in today that are going to go through certification that are using more than two cores. So the CAS 32 guidance will have to evolve. We will learn more, and there will be additional guidance that will have to be published. So I fully expect we'll see more as we go. But the good part about CAS 32 and the EASA guidance that preceded it is that it puts a stake in the ground for us to build on and evolve.
Vance, are there DO-178 specifications for microprocessor sandwich layer architectures?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, one of the beauties of DO-178 is that it's blind to specific architectures and implementations. One of the banes, one of the challenges with 178 is the same example. It doesn't have those details. So there's nothing within 178 that talks about that specifically. And so it's incumbent upon the developer to specify what the certification issues are in their PSEC, Plan for Software Aspect Certification, further clarify that in a development plan, how they're going to develop low-level requirements and ensure determinism and provability. And then in the third plan, verification plan, how they're going to do specific reviews, what the review criteria are for examining that, what the added robustness tests are. There's nothing extra for functional testing outside of the additional requirements and structural coverage testing, and then the analysis. So unfortunately, the answer is no. It's incumbent upon the developer to define those.
So, Kurt, I'll chime in there also. I'm going to take a stab at what's behind that question potentially. Is we've seen customers come to us, and I showed you an example of the complex SoC from Intel earlier, where you had the graphics portion of that silicon taking up a rather large footprint and making up a large number of the gates inside that silicon. And if this question was related to, say, well, how do I verify the behavior of that graphics component? And certainly DO254 was meant to address, you know, the complex hardware design. And, you know, in theory, you could use DO254 to verify, you know, the layout design and implementation of that graphics portion at SoC. However, it just, what we're saying here today is it's just impractical to do that. The time and money required to get that done would just not lead to a successful outcome that would be economically viable. So we have to use other techniques to help verify behavior, especially when it comes down to things like these architectures that are a lot more complicated than they used to be.
There's a question having to do with hypervisors and multiprocessor software environments separating different OSs. How can you address compliance or certification of a hypervisor that you may be using from another vendor, or how does that complicate or simplify the certification process in that case?
Well, if you're going to use a hypervisor, and CAS 32 talks about it, there's hardware hypervisors and there's software hypervisors that are part of the CAS 32 objectives. And so one way to certainly control, and verify that behavior is to buy, you know, the proprietary implementation from a vendor. Like Wind River, we do this. We have a virtualization environment and software that enables you to have guest operating environments on top of our virtualization technology, whereby we can enforce the behavior and control the execution environment with that hypervisor. So that's one way. But if you want to use an open source one or a third party one on your own, then you will be responsible for doing the verification activities of that software and or hardware to meet the CAS 32 objectives. So in my mind, the way to address it is to simply work with your vendors to get that technology and make that available to you, because doing that yourself could be a very complex and arduous and time-consuming effort.
Vance, what about accelerometers and other larger mechanical-related parts and materials? How does that figure in?
Oh, that's a good question. Systems like that that are complex with a real deep domain knowledge, there's no one silver bullet for the verification, especially with multi-core. Let me bring up a slide I'm going to push to the audience right here. This slide I glossed over all too quickly. The standard B model, we know what that is. The left side of the B, the blue, talks about the different realms, the depths of requirements, the architecture, system design, module design, and then verify. So with those accelerometers, complex systems with deep domain knowledge, there's no one form of testing, unit testing, module integration system, that will do it all. And that's related to my comment on the need for automated regression testing and continuous-based testing across all those realms of test verification. So with accelerometers, we've got the internal design. We've got a need for increased throughput that we use multi-core processing on. But then we've got the external inputs and outputs that we'd be testing at the system. So we need to test at the low level, the module unit level, the interactions between the algorithms, the internal software interfaces, at the integration level, the interactions between modules across cores, and then moving up the right-hand side of the V at the system level. If we have to do that all manually, let's be honest, it's expensive and time-consuming, and a defect could be introduced that wasn't checked. Well, with continuous-based automated regression testing, we can handle that better. So that the answer lies in ensuring that we have complete testing across our toolbox as required by both CAS32 and BO178C Section 6, but then make sure we have an automated continuous-based testing to make it practical so it's actually cost-effective. That'd be my answer.
Okay, great. Joe, there's a question about board support packages and multi-core and the impact of verification on those things. Do you think BSPs will require significant additions of defensive programming to control the number of possible hardware states?
Yes, that's certainly, I think, to be expected. What we're if you look at the slide that I had earlier on the CAS32 compliance matrix, you know, there was one objective there that says the integrator is going to be responsible for, you know, some of the elements of compliance with that particular objective of ensuring non-interference. And that's one example where the implementation of the BSP will play a key role of constraining the behavior of the system, because the BSP effectively has the same level or access to the same level of privileges that the operating system has. So there are certainly ways to constrain the behavior of the environment using those types of techniques, and certainly that's going to be an implementation level decision.
Okay, and there's a related question about Wind River's focus on PowerPC and Intel. Is that are you supporting both equally?
Well, it depends on the product technology we're talking about, but our 653 technology largely today has been built on PowerPC. That's the 653 technology that's used in about 300 programs, and literally, you know, multiple approvals at DO-178. That's largely been PowerPC. But in the multi-core world, we're starting on PowerPC. Intel's following closely. ARM is there as well. It's really just the customers are making those choices today. But my point is I would not be, impaired or choosy about which one. From a risk point of view, I think they're equally capable of supporting certification requirements. But the choice for the customers are, you know, does it meet your needs? Power, size, weight, and power consumption, that kind of thing. Architecture doesn't meet your needs. Let that drive the decision on which architecture you choose.
Okay. Vance, have you seen efforts where for commercial off-the-shelf platforms that are utilizing multi-core hardwares and systems platforms, are there things being done to specifically design ease of certification capabilities within them?
You know, that's a great question, and to be honest, I'm only working on three projects right now with any awareness of what's being done, and those are all fairly proprietary. I will say that they're placing a lot of reliance on operating systems and on CAS32, but real focus on the core assignments and initially using either two cores in initial baseline or four cores with a clearly defined, non-changing, non-dynamic core affinity that streamlines that. So the old saying, keep it simple, I forget what the second S stood for, but KISS probably goes a long way there.
Right. Okay, great. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Thank you very much to Joe and Vance for sharing your expertise in FAA regulatory guidance for multi-core use and certified avionics systems. We at Open Systems Media, Wind River, and Vector Software want to thank you, the audience, for attending and contributing excellent questions remotely. We did not get to all of them, but they will be sent to our presenters for follow-up. So you'll be sure to either reach out to them or they'll be reaching out to you with respect to those additional questions. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen in 24 hours. Note that an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. Thank you all for attending, and have a great day.